Hello, folks. This is Will Aitchison. I'd like to welcome you to a special podcast from Labor Relations Information System. We normally do two types of podcasts. We have our First Thursday podcast, which comes out once a month, where we try to bring you up to date on recent developments of significance in the public safety workplace. Also, from time to time, I'll interview various people, usually lawyers, but not always lawyers, around the country, management and labor representatives, talking to them about issues that are of significance that have happened in which they've been personally involved. This podcast today is in a third category. We've never done this before. I hope to do it quite frequently in the future. I've just finished the process of writing the seventh edition of a book called The Rights of Law Enforcement Officers. I started writing this book in the 1980s. Hate to think it goes back that far, but it does. And every 4 or 5 years, I will update it. And that is a process that is a very lengthy process. It involves reading every case involving the constitutional or statutory rights, every published decision involving law enforcement officers. We have seen in the last few years, we've seen this dramatic explosion of litigation involving the rights of law enforcement officers. And I can measure that when I do these various updates. You know, for example, where once upon a time, over a five-year period of time, there might only be 200 or 300 cases to read involving the free speech rights of law enforcement officers. This time, there were in excess of 3,000 cases that I had to take a look at. This explosion of litigation has been, I think of it both horizontal and vertical. Horizontal in the sense that there are, vertical in the sense that there are just simply more cases in each area. Horizontal in the sense that we've got litigation over issues now that we never used to have litigation over. And one of them arises out of what are now known as Brady lists. We've got a chapter in the new book on Brady lists. I didn't even address Brady the last time the book was issued because there just wasn't that much going on in the area. This is perhaps one of the most striking developments in the employment lives of law enforcement officers, certainly in the time that I have been practicing. What I want to do with this podcast is to go over what has happened with Brady. What's it all about? What are the developments under Brady? And what are we seeing out there in the courts now under Brady? I want to go over all of that. Also, because you're sitting through and listening to these podcasts, we want to just make available to you without charge that chapter in the book. You can just contact us at LRIS.com, info@LRIS.com, and we will point you to a link where you can download that chapter of the book together with all of the footnote goodness that comes with these chapters. Okay, let's talk Brady now. Brady is a 50-year-old decision, it's older than 50 years, that comes to us from the United States Supreme Court. And it is a case that actually lay dormant for a long time in the employment setting. And now we've had, as I used the term before, this explosion of litigation in the area of Brady, and that has led to practices that are wildly inconsistent from state to state and sometimes even from jurisdiction to jurisdiction within each state. There's an article published in the Stanford Law Review. You can find it online free of charge. I think this Law Review article sums it up pretty well. And I'm just going to read you a couple of sentences from this Law Review article. What the author says is, an officer who cannot testify, a so-called Brady cop, may find herself out of work and unemployable. As such, an officer cannot make arrests, investigate cases, or carry out other duties that might put her on the witness stand. Moreover, officers fear that prosecutors and police supervisors will use access to the files to abuse Brady Cop designation by labeling officers as Brady Cops in order to punish them outside of formal disciplinary channels and those channels' attendant procedural protections. Yeah, that is what the perception of some, many rank-and-file law enforcement officers is. How did we get into this situation? Well, Brady itself is a criminal case, and it's a case that involves a criminal defendant's rights to, if you think of it in these terms, pretrial discovery. It kind of has its roots in the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. And what Brady itself says is that the prosecution has a pretrial obligation to disclose evidence. Evidence favorable to the defendant, it must disclose that information to the defendant. And over the years, since Brady was issued, and again, over 50 years ago, the Supreme Court has pretty steadily, though not spectacularly, expanded Brady. First up was the Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Giglio. Sometimes you even hear of the Brady rule as being called the Brady-Giglio rule or the Giglio rule. The Supreme Court held in Giglio that this obligation to disclose potentially exculpatory information it also applies to potential impeachment evidence. So in other words, if someone is going to take the stand and testify against the criminal defendant, the prosecution has an obligation to disclose to the defendant information that could be used to impeach that individual. And probably most notably, in 1985, the Supreme Court issued a decision in a case called United States versus Bagley that said that the obligation to disclose information doesn't need to be triggered by a request from the defendant. It is a obligation imposed on the prosecution. So the prosecution simply has to do this in every case, even if the defendant doesn't ask. And then the last notable extension of Brady happens in 1995 in a case called Kiles versus Whitley, where the court ends up saying that this obligation to disclose extends to all parts of, if you will, the prosecution team, that a prosecutor has a duty to learn of favorable evidence known to others acting on the government's behalf in a case, including the police. Supreme Court has never decided, never addressed, whether or not Brady extends to police disciplinary and internal investigatory files. However, while that issue is unsettled at the Supreme Court level, a number of lower courts have begun to address that issue. And most courts say, look, what we've got to do is we have to start off by figuring when there is even potentially an obligation to disclose. And here we find the first of our inconsistent rules under Brady. Some courts will say that a defendant has to make a showing of potential relevance before you even start down the road toward disclosure of disciplinary and internal affairs files. That a defendant has to make some showing that there is material evidence in these files. And other courts say that and there is no such obligation to make such a disclosure. Now, what's the rationale of both lines of thought? First of all, the courts that say that a defendant has to make some sort of showing of relevant evidence before it gets even potential access to disciplinary and internal affairs files these courts just simply don't want law enforcement agencies to be burdened by turning over all of this information in every single case. Federal Court of Appeals, used this charming metaphor, saying that a defendant is entitled to fish, but not with this thin a pole. Courts phrase this obligation that a defendant has to make a showing of potential relevant information is one, they phrase it in terms of there must be good cause to believe that a disciplinary file contains impeachable evidence. What about the other line of cases? Well, the other line of cases pretty much starts and ends, not completely, with the Federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This is the Federal Court of Appeals in the western part of the United States, covers most of the states west of the Rocky Mountains. The Ninth Circuit is known, somewhat unfairly, but not always unfairly, is known for sometimes marching to the beat of its own drummer in case law. Where other courts might go direction A on an issue, the Ninth Circuit may go direction B. And that is the case in the Ninth Circuit on this question of the initial showing that a criminal defendant has to make. There's a case called United States versus Hemthorne. It's from 1991. And by the way, if you download this chapter on the book, we'll have electronic copies of all of these cases for you on what you download. You'll be able to get the links to all of these cases. In Hemthorne, the Ninth Circuit rules that a defendant doesn't have to make any showing to trigger the Brady process, and instead says that the government, meaning prosecutors, local cooperating law enforcement agencies, have to conduct their own examination of officer files and have to start the Brady process all on their own. Ninth Circuit has later said that a prosecutor can assign the obligation to review officer files to cooperating law enforcement agencies. It doesn't have to do the review itself. And as a result of all of this, we began to see a procedure develop in these Brady cases. And really, this started in the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office and spread outwards to the extent that it spread, because it still doesn't exist in some places in the country. But really, it started there. And the procedure was roughly this. A defendant would ask for an officer's file. A trial court would make some sort of initial assessment as to whether the defendant had made the requisite showing that there might be Brady evidence in the files. In the Ninth Circuit, of course, not even that. The court would then require the prosecution to produce the relevant portion of the files for what's called an in-camera inspection, which means that the judge will review the materials in chambers and then will decide whether or not there has to be disclosure of those materials. If there is disclosure, usually the disclosure order puts restrictions on the defense attorney and the criminal defendant, prohibiting the use of the Brady material in any other proceeding other than the prosecution itself, and that imposes potential criminal liability for violation of those sorts of orders. That's roughly the procedure that has developed. Well, we began to see that formalized in 1996. And remember, let's go back. That Hemthorne case from the Ninth Circuit is in 1991. What we see in 1996 is the Department of Justice adopting what it calls a Giglio policy. Why are those dates important? Well, the Department of Justice, the United States Department of Justice, prosecutes cases in all 50 states, several of which are in the Ninth Circuit. So the Department of Justice makes the, I think, not unreasonable judgment that it's a good idea to have one policy for the entire DOJ, and because some of the courts covered by the DOJ are in the Ninth Circuit, whatever that policy is, had better comply with the Ninth Circuit's rules. Under the current version of that policy, and it's been rewritten several times, and that policy is available online, and once again, you can find a link to it in the footnotes of the book. Under the current version of that policy, prosecutors have to initiate a review of officer files, even in the absence of a request from a defendant. That's the Ninth Circuit again. And law enforcement agencies are required to disclose to the DOJ information falling in any of seven categories. So that means that whenever you have an officer who is potentially a witness in a criminal case, local law enforcement agencies cooperating with the Department of Justice have to look at the officer's files and see if there's anything in seven categories. What are the seven categories? Seven categories are these. Number one, any finding of misconduct that reflects upon truthfulness or bias of the employee, whatever that finding of misconduct might be. So untruthfulness, a record of untruthfulness. Number two, past or pending criminal charges against employee. Third, an allegation of misconduct bearing upon truthfulness or bias or integrity. That's the subject of a pending investigation. So not only does a department have to identify, or a local law enforcement agency have to identify findings of untruthfulness, but also pending investigations into untruthfulness. Category number four, findings by a judge that an employee has testified untruthfully in some fashion. Fifth, either a misconduct finding or pending misconduct allegation that casts doubt on the accuracy of the evidence that the prosecutor intends to rely on. Number six, information that suggests that the employee is biased for or against a particular defendant. And last, information that reflects that the employee, the officer, may have a problem perceiving and recalling the truth. The big ones here are numbers one and three. And that, roughly speaking, one and three capture findings of untruthfulness or allegations of untruthfulness. And the Department of Justice policy says that cooperating agencies with the Department of Justice, when you have a federal criminal prosecution, have to go through their files, and if anything falls in one of these seven categories, have to produce it for the Department of Justice to review to decide whether or not the Department of Justice will then in turn notify the criminal defendant that there's potential Brady information, and that ticks off the process that results in the in-camera hearing. Now, that's federal criminal prosecutions. What about the vast majority of prosecutions in which law enforcement officers are involved, state criminal prosecutions? What's going on at that level? And here, again, you see a tremendous inconsistency of response from state and local prosecutor offices and local law enforcement agencies. Some, many, I don't want to say most because I haven't done head count, but I can say many, have simply ignored Brady entirely. They don't have any procedures in place to deal with Brady information. They don't have anything that remotely resembles the Department of Justice rules on the issue. They simply ignore Brady. The way any Brady issue comes up is on a case-by-case basis, and they decide how they're going to handle it on a case-by-case basis. Others follow the Department of Justice approach, and in fact have begun maintaining what are called Brady lists. These are lists usually maintained by a prosecution office that have a list of the names of officers who have potentially disclosable Brady information. How do officers get on a Brady list? Well, that varies tremendously, again, from agency to agency and from state to state. Usually, there's three ways that that happens. First is when the employer notifies the prosecutor's office that an officer has been disciplined for dishonesty or some other reason that justifies placement on a Brady list. Secondly, it may be that a member of the prosecutor's office has a concern about the testimony of an officer and whether or not it has been truthful. And on the basis of that, we'll place an officer on a Brady list. And the third way is when an officer is convicted of a crime. Occasionally, you will see an officer placed on a Brady list when a criminal defense attorney brings forth questions about the officer's honesty, but usually it's the three ways that I have lined out. What's the significance of being on a Brady list? And here again, we see wildly varying standards depending on where you are around the country. Some places respond to an officer being on a Brady list, the local law enforcement agency fires the officer. And the rationale is, look, part of the essential functions of the job of being a police officer is being able to testify. If you put on a Brady list, you can't testify, you can't do the essential functions of the job, you're terminated. Other agencies simply do nothing and say, okay, officer's on the Brady list. Prosecutor, you're just simply going to have to deal with that. We don't think we have a basis to discipline the officer again or in a particular case, and therefore we are going to keep the officer employed. As you can imagine, there's a big area in the middle between automatic discharge and we're going to do nothing. That may be, for example, having officers in what I've heard described as the penalty box for a period of time, a few months, a year, a few years, where they're in non-line assignments or in assignments where they're not called upon to testify on a regular basis. It may mean assigning officers to jobs where if they are required to testify, there'd always be another officer on the scene who could testify. So there's a big middle between we don't do anything in response to an officer being put on a Brady list, and we're going to fire all officers on a Brady list. Recently, we've come to see what I think of as a much more nuanced view on the issue of untruthfulness. You know how it's been for years and years and years in police academies. Officers are told, look, you die, you die. If you are untruthful, we're going to terminate you. We don't care what the untruthfulness is. We'll stand behind you if you're truthful. You just tell us the truth. But the one cardinal sin in policing, absolutely a cardinal sin, is untruthfulness. We are seeing that position soften in a variety of different forums. And we're seeing it soften because of the harshness of those agencies that automatically terminate officers who are placed on a Brady list. Courts are starting to say, not just courts, arbitrators, and even state legislatures are starting to say, you know, we need to take a more holistic view of the whole issue of untruthfulness of a law enforcement officer. So where are we seeing this? How are we seeing this? The first place, as I said, is in legislatures. In the last year and a half, two state legislatures, California and Maryland, concerned about Brady lists, the expansion of Brady lists, and the potential for the unwarranted ending of careers of law enforcement officers who are placed on a Brady list. We've seen these legislatures amend statewide Peace Officers' Bill of Rights to say that mere placement on a Brady list cannot be the basis for discipline. The underlying untruthfulness can be a basis for discipline, but simply being put on the Brady list in and of itself cannot be. So that's just two states so far, but it's happened in the last year and a half. It's a pretty recent development. Secondly, we have seen both arbitrators and courts take a what I think of as a more nuanced view of termination. Of dishonesty. We have seen some courts actually holding that what you might think of as more minor levels of dishonesty need not result in termination. We've got set forth for you in the book a recent decision, it's only a few months old now, from the Connecticut Supreme Court that upholds an arbitrator's opinion reinstating an officer who lied during a fitness for duty evaluation. And what does the court say? The court says, in essence, and I'm translating here, there are lies and there are lies. There are lies that impact the constitutional rights of a suspect, that impact a suspect's liberty or a suspect's property. Those are the most serious types of lies. And then there are more minor lies about everyday personnel matters. And the more minor lies, they don't necessarily need to end in termination. And the court upholds this arbitrator's opinion, reinstating an officer who was admittedly untruthful in a fitness for duty evaluation. Listen to what this court says. I actually think a couple of sentences here are worth quoting because they show what I've described as this nuanced view. Here's the court. The officer's conduct, although serious, did not compromise his qualifications or ability to perform his official duties as a police officer. The officer did not lie under oath, and his dishonesty was not disruptive or repeated. He was not dishonest before his fellow police officers or while performing his official duties. He was not warned about the repercussions of his misconduct, and he was not incorrigible. And the punishment that he did receive from the arbitrator, lengthy suspension, was severe. We've also seen this nuanced view in an unusual way in the courts involving arbitrators' opinions. The fact situation that comes up, and it's come up now, I'd say easily a dozen times in a variety of different states, is where you have an officer terminated for untruthfulness. An arbitrator reinstates the officer, finding that the officer, while untruthful, that there were mitigating circumstances that justified reinstatement. Perhaps the officer's lengthy good work record, perhaps external stressors on the officer, physical or emotional stressors on the officer, whatever the mitigating circumstances may be. The arbitrator reinstates the officer, and then the employer refuses to comply with the arbitrator's opinion, citing what's known as the public policy exception to the finality of arbitration decisions. What's that? Arbitrator's decisions are thought of as being final and binding. However, there is this exception that when the arbitrator's opinion would violate a clearly established and dominant, that's the phrasing, clearly established and dominant public policy, then a court won't uphold the arbitrator's opinion. And what employers are saying is, look, there's a very clearly established and dominant public policy against law enforcement officers who lie. And an arbitrator's opinion reinstating a dishonest police officer has to violate public policy. And most courts, almost all, I can only think of two to the contrary, reject that position by employers. And why is that? What courts say is what we have to look at in these public policy cases is not whether the officer's conduct violated public policy. Everybody can agree that it's against public policy for a police officer to lie, but rather whether or not the order of reinstatement violates public policy. In other words, does public policy necessarily and exclusively mandate termination? And courts say, no, it doesn't. Public policy clearly requires discipline, but there's not say these courts. You can go out there and look in statutes. You can look in other court opinions, say these courts. There's nothing that says that the only discipline for untruthfulness needs to be termination. And there's a Washington Supreme Court opinion involving Kitsap County, Washington. That's a county that's fairly close to Seattle. There's a Washington Supreme Court opinion that we quote in the book. And again, I want to read just a couple of sentences on this because it's so emblematic of other court decisions. Courts in other states have upheld similar arbitrations, says the Washington Supreme Court, reinstating officers where there is no explicit, well-defined, and dominant public policy against reinstatement, even where reinstatement would likely be contrary to general public policy considerations. Washington statutes prohibit making false statements to a public officer, but there is no statute or other explicit, well-defined, and dominant expression of public policy that requires the automatic termination of an officer found to be untruthful. So what we are seeing then is this nuanced position, if you will, on untruthfulness evolve out of the Brady Rule. And I really think what's going on here is you've got a perception out there that the creation of these Brady lists too often results in a harsh result. And the harsh result is the ending of a peace officer's career. And that's why you see these cracks in the armor, that untruthfulness will always result in discharge. And now you're seeing, I've seen this actually in Oregon. I've seen it with the State Peace Officers Standards and Training Commission in Oregon. It's actually called the Department on Public Safety Standards and Training. They've got a statewide Brady Protocol. And that Brady Protocol actually includes within it a recognition of gradations of untruthfulness. Now, just a few other things about Brady before I conclude this podcast. What about officers who think they're wrongly placed on a Brady list? What can they do about it? How about not just wrongly placed on a Brady list, but are fired for being wrongly placed on a Brady list? We've had several examples of where police officers have sued prosecutors. After all, it's the prosecutors who are creating the Brady list, have sued prosecutors saying, you wrongly deprived me of due process, you didn't give me a hearing, and you have wrongly put me on a Brady list. I wasn't untruthful. Courts reject those lawsuits. And the reason courts reject those lawsuits is there's a principle that's known as absolute prosecutorial immunity. And that means that prosecutors can't be sued for any reason, even if they're wrong, even if they're acting maliciously, they can't be sued for any actions they take that are, and the normal phrasing is, actions that are intimately associated with the judicial phrase of the criminal process. So these lawsuits, courts, the way you see courts resolve these lawsuits is they say, look, we're going to assume for purposes of this lawsuit that the officer is right, that the prosecutor wrongly placed the officer on a Brady list. Even still, there is no basis for suing the prosecutor. I think one of the more poignant cases here, maybe the most poignant case, it's not a reported opinion, but it hit all the newspapers. It again comes out of Oregon. It involves a small town prosecutor who sued by a police sergeant in a smaller town, and the police sergeant said in his lawsuit, you put me on a Brady list, and you know why you put me on the Brady list? Because I endorsed your opponent for re-election. The court ends up tossing the police sergeant's lawsuit on absolute liability grounds, or absolute immunity grounds, saying even if that is true, placement on a Brady list is shielded by absolute immunity. And there again, we get back to this notion that I've been stressing throughout, and that is this notion that there's a perception, once you get these things actually in litigation, there's a perception that the Brady list result can be a very harsh result, too harsh a result. And so that's why you see this softening in the area of untruthfulness. That's it. That's an overview of the Brady Rule. As I mentioned to you, please do go download the chapter. We've got all sorts of links to cases, to Brady itself. By the way, if you're interested in this sort of thing and you have enough spare time in your life, you can actually go to a web page called OYE, O-Y-E-Z. I'll explain that in a moment. OYE, and you can listen to the oral arguments before the Supreme Court in Brady and Giglio and Bagley and Kyles versus Whitley. If you know, they've actually got the tapes online. If they're not tapes now, they're digital, but you can listen to the lawyers and the justices asking questions in those cases. It's kind of a fun thing to do from time to time. We've also got links for you in there, as I mentioned, to not only the Department of Justice Giglio policy, but some of these arbitrators' decisions from around the country and court decisions from around the country, as well as links to newspaper articles and Police Chief magazine articles on the Brady Rule. That's it. Hope to see you again for another LRIS podcast. And by the way, if you're interested in purchasing the 7th edition of the Rights of Law Enforcement Officers, we're always glad to sell you a book. You can do that by going to LRIS.com. You'll see our publications section there. You can also order it through Amazon, but if you order it through Amazon, put bluntly, we get less of a cut. So we hope you go to our webpage. This is Will Aitchison signing off, and thank you for listening.